Hi, this is Barbara Peters. I am here with Dennis Palumbo, and it is February 24th, and we have just published his new book, Head Wounds, fifth in the Daniel Rinaldo series. Rinaldo. So, Dennis, this is book five.
That's right.
Is this the one that you have found? I always ask authors this, and they always say yes, but still, the most exciting to write?
It was absolutely the most exciting to write for two reasons. One of which is that all the characters in Daniel's life are at risk, which is something I've never done before. And I've also never done one of my mystery thrillers where we know who the bad guy is pretty early on, about 40 pages in. And so it becomes a cat and mouse game between my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, and the villain. And I'd never done that before. And I found that it was a challenge to make each interaction between them more and more scary, more and more suspenseful, and yet build to a psychological conclusion that made sense.
Yes, and I think you did it with brilliance. But this book, in fact, is a thriller. Your earlier books have been more investigations, in a pure mystery sense, whereas this one is the classic protagonist, antagonist, and thriller. And you're right, it is a completely different structure.
Yeah, I have seen so many books where the lead character's friends are apparently threatened by someone. And it always feels like, for the reader, well, nothing bad's going to happen to them. They're recurring characters, and this is the hero, nothing bad's going to happen to them. And I really wanted to make the reader go, gosh, I hope they all survive this. I hope they get through this, including my hero, Daniel Rinaldi. It's also a very emotional book because it all keys around the death of his wife.
Which is something you set up way back in the beginning to explain why he's a consultant with the police.
That's right. His survivor guilt after her death, when they were both shot, but he survived. And his survivor guilt, which took him years to deal with, was the source of what he calls his mission, which is to treat and help the victims of violent crime, people who've been traumatized by crime, those who've survived a kidnapping or a sexual assault or a home invasion, but still live with the after effects, what the symptoms that we tend to associate with post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, eternal vigilance of danger, fear, the idea that any time or any place they could be in danger again, and often with the feeling that had they done something differently, a person they knew or cared about or loved wouldn't have been injured. So they have their own survivor guilt as well.
And in fact, by writing this book, you're going to end up purging Daniel, depending on how it all plays out, perhaps purging him of that guilt.
Well, that was one of the things that I thought about, is because he's carried the guilt for five books. And I think this kind of completes a particular kind of gestalt with him.
Yes, it's a story arc that has carried you over five books, and now you can start a different one.
And I can kind of go in a different way, particularly because I believe closure is a myth. I think what happens, as a therapist, I can tell you that people do survive and navigate trauma, but it's with them the rest of their lives. It may not spike in as acute a way as it does soon after the event or for months or years after, but it's still there, and it helps form a view of the world. You know, once you've been in a traumatic situation, you don't see the world the way you did before.
It also has distanced him from other people in a way, because you only have a few characters that he is connected with.
In
a personal way, as opposed to the professional ways that he's gone about it. And you haven't been kind to him. It's not like the first four books he had an easy ride.
No. In fact, his relationship history is somewhat troubled. And I think that what I like is that he seems a totally contemporary man. But he's also formed from a blue-collar background that is not reflected in his professional life at all now. And so his relatives would just like him to settle down with a nice woman and get married and have a pass full of kids. I don't know if Daniel Rinaldi's capable of that.
Or if he even wants that.
Or if he even wants it. Yeah. I'm not sure what he wants. And the reason that I think Head Wounds affects the people that have read it and have begun emailing me and calling me, and there have been a lot, people are really affected by this book. I think the reason it affects them so much is because Daniel's now like off the edge of a cliff. We don't know what's going to happen to his life. But just knowing what had happened to his wife, Barbara, and how the person who did what he did to Barbara impacts all these other people in Daniel's life, you really get the sense that we're all interconnected.
Yes.
And we all have these kinds of operatic passions. You know, I always say to people, if you talk to the box boy at the local supermarket who's never said more than two words to you, so you go in the back and you have a 20-minute conversation and you hear about a family with divorce, gambling addiction, suicide, mental illness, and it's like a soap opera. And so in my experience, people have these operatic passions. We don't see them in our daily lives. Unless we're really intimately involved with someone, we really don't know their story.
No, we don't. And also, I think it takes a traumatic event often to open up that a tunnel towards that. I mean, we all get along, you know, when you say, how are you? You don't really expect an in-depth answer.
Yeah.
You know, it's more sort of just social machinery that you're oiling. So there really needs to be circumstances where, you know, people are forced to strip down and also bare themselves in a way. And he does relate that way. It's been true in the earlier books that I think maybe more so in the last one. Is that Phantom Limb?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he's been kind of on this path. So you've brought your own years of experience as a therapist into writing this series. Do you think that someone without that could really have written Head Wounds?
I don't think so. Frankly, between Phantom Limb and Head Wounds, it's pretty clear that whoever wrote these two books knows about clinical practice.
Right.
I mean, the thing that I remember having a conversation with Thomas Perry, who said that what he loved about Phantom Limb is that I risked the first three chapters being a therapy session between Daniel Rinaldi and Lisa Campbell. And he said, I can't believe how you made that so interesting, but I also saw the way Daniel's mind works.
Mm-hmm.
And so because my books are written in the first person, the reader really gets a look inside the way a therapist thinks. And it isn't the way it's conventionally shown on television or in movies. It's much more conflicted. There's many more feeling states that the therapist has. And in Phantom Limb in particular, his relationship with a difficult patient was one of my favorite things about the book.
Yes, I thought, well, and your books are always surprising. I think that, you know, I know it's hard work to plot books that are as twisty and devious as yours, mm-hmm. but it does take a lot of energy to do that, and I think the reader feels that. I think in Head Wounds, it's hard not to become emotionally exhausted reading it for the various, you know, the peril situation, just the twist in the plot, and as you said, you really worry whether Daniel will survive it.
Yeah, and in fact, I remember at one point in the book where he said, I didn't know it, but you know, this day was going to be the beginning of the most harrowing event of my life. And I thought, you know, if you're going to write that, Dennis, this better be harrowing.
Yes, you really have to make that payoff.
You have to make that payoff, and I think that I did. And in fact, I'm really clear that the next book is going to be a little more just straight procedural like the earlier ones and not involve anyone in his personal life, because I don't think people go through what Daniel went through in Head Wounds like a bunch of times. I think go through that once.
And I also think that if you're writing a series, you can't credibly continue to put him through that kind of thing. And also, he is a professional. He is a consultant to the police department. He's there because he has, you know, his therapy expertise. Why wouldn't he get cases that, you know, are just because that's his job? There was a writer years ago my mother was very fond of called Del Shannon, and nobody remembers her now, but you remember her now. And she wrote like a zillion books that were made mostly into book club things eventually. But I love the realism of the fact that Lieutenant Luis Mendoza, her main character, worked in the LAPD And you know, they were working multiple cases, and so she would write a book with two or three different cases going on at once, and they didn't all tie together. They were just two or three different cases, you know,
Well, I
and
had the same warm feeling toward Ed McBain with his 87
yes.
precinct books,
Yes.
because the professionalism is a very important part for me. I'm lucky because I know Paul Bishop, who's a former LAPD detective, and so we talk. And I did a lot of research on people who consult with the police, and I deliberately made him not be a police psychologist. I wanted him to be a consultant. I wanted him to be freelance and have his own private practice. What ends up happening if you're a police psychologist is a little bit like being an army chaplain. You end up kind of playing the party line. You know, the police psychologist's job is to determine whether a policeman after an event like a shooting is suitable to go back to the field. And the pressure on the police psychologist is get him back in the field as fast as possible. The only good thing about that that I like is that they are not required to divulge any information. The police psychologist who interviews a policeman who's been through like a shooting event is only required to write, can return to duty, not return to duty. Like any other psychologist, everything that is said in that room is confidential, which I
Or
was
like a
glad,
priest,
or
really,
like a
like going to
priest. Yeah,
confession.
I was
Yeah,
very happy
not,
to hear that. But
yeah.
with Daniel, I wanted him to have a private practice and to be a consultant. So frankly, he'd have more mobility. And I also wanted the police not to be happy about it.
That's a good point. So it gives
Yeah,
you extra conflict
it
in the
gives me a
book.
lot of extra conflict. In fact, in both Phantom Limb and Head Wounds, Lieutenant Beigler, who is the head of robbery homicide at the Pittsburgh Police, is actively trying to yank his contract. Particularly because Daniel, one of my little nods to the modern world, Daniel has become kind of a well-known talking head on CNN. And the last thing the police want is someone who's become sort of a celebrity talker about cases. I mean, Paul told me that like they really had a problem with Dominic Dunn because he kept going on CNN and talking about police cases.
Open cases.
Open
Yeah,
cases.
you can talk about
And so Daniel
closed.
Rinaldi has, you know, become sort of a well-known talking head that the Pittsburgh police are just very unhappy about.
Well, I can see why it would make them
Oh,
uneasy.
yeah.
Now, you've mentioned the magic word, Pittsburgh. Why is the Daniel Rinaldi series set in Pittsburgh?
Two reasons. Number one, I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and I've always loved this city. But secondly, because it's really undergone a transformation very different from almost any other city in America. I mean, Baltimore is Baltimore and Cleveland is Cleveland. Pittsburgh now literally does not look like Pittsburgh from 30 years or 40 years ago. When I went through college, I worked at J&L Steel Mill on 2nd Avenue. Those mills are all gone. They're all replaced with fancy-dancy shopping malls and gentrified areas. And it's gone from being a blue-collar industrial town to a white-collar technological town.
Technological and medical.
And medical,
Yeah.
technological and medical. It's practically the number one place in the world for transplants. And the state-of-the-art nanotechnology and the number one place for robotics.
Right. I hadn't realized that. I haven't been to Pittsburgh for a few years, but even I could tell. The rivers are cleaned up, the
Yeah.
skyline is different. One of the things I think is interesting is with the advent of river cruising, there are now trips that go down the Ohio and start, of course, in Pittsburgh, you
Sure.
know, and journey towards the Mississippi. But you're right. And interestingly, you know, Detroit's another city that is now in the middle of some sort of
It's in the middle of what
reinvention.
it's trying to do what Pittsburgh did. Because one of the things Pittsburgh has done, I mean, the RAND Corporation says it's the number one city in America to live. And it's for two reasons. Number one, they've cleaned it all up. The air is great and everything. But people often forget it's so well endowed. There's the Mellons, the
Right.
Scapes, the Carnegies, the Heinzes. It's loaded with money. So you have operas and museums and, you know, hospital wings. And there's just a ton of money there. And so the downside is a lot of the neighborhoods that were very, very provincial have all become gentrified. And many people who lived in the same house that their parents did and grandparents did, they can't even afford the rents in those places anymore.
Do you know, that's actually true in Scottsdale, not so much of housing, but the Arabian horse people. I ran into some on the plane coming back from Nashville yesterday. It used to be that right up north of where we are sitting on Bell Road, there was a very large Arabian horses ranch called Chauncey's. And they've now been forced to move way out into the desert. And, you know, Santa Fe, Aspen, all kinds of cities have gone through neighborhoods in New York, the same exact issue.
There's a district in a little town outside of Pittsburgh called Lawrenceville that has always been kind of like a Soho or Greenwich Village place where low-rent artists and beatniks and hippies used to live. They're all gone now. It's all hedge fund managers and plastic surgeons, and they live in these million-dollar condos. And it's become so gentrified that the people who've lived there for generations can't stay there anymore.
So that loses cohesion for these people. A lot of them are united by religion, they were kind of tribal, weren't they?
Very tribal.
Right.
As I say in my book, it's where ethnic pride and ethnic prejudice live side by side. And it is true. I mean, the thing that's so striking is generations of people used to work in the steel industry, gone. They used to work in the coal mines outside, gone. You know that song of Billy Joel's Allentown? That's about Allentown, Pennsylvania, right, and what happened to the economy.
Sure.
And so those jobs are not coming back.
Nope.
And what's happened is young people have come to Pittsburgh to do jobs very different than the kinds that their parents did.
Yep.
And so the town itself is changing. It feels kind of sheeshy. When you walk downtown or you're on the south side, it's either filled with these high-end chains or very expensive cafes and restaurants. And it feels a little... It's so funny. I don't know if you remember the movie Flashdance, and everyone laughed and said, because it was shot in Pittsburgh.
It was.
And everybody said, Jesus, it made it look like Paris. Well, it kind of looks like Paris now.
Well, it's got a she-she feeling.
It has a very she-she feeling, a very upscale feeling. And people like my parents and their friends don't feel as comfortable downtown as they used to. They don't feel, they stay in the suburbs more because the town itself has become... It's like going to Manhattan if you lived in Brooklyn or the Bronx. It just seems a little too highfalutin.
Well, so is Brooklyn, since you mentioned Brooklyn. Brooklyn is no longer Brooklyn.
Oh,
I grew up in Chicago, and I remember when Gary, Indiana, and Pittsburgh were, you know, nearly synonymous.
Oh, I know.
And I haven't been back, so I don't know where condition Gary's in. But you're right, the steel mills are gone and not coming back, and the coal industry. Well, tell me this. How do your readers from Pittsburgh like the way you write about Pittsburgh, or do you get called out every now and then?
They love the fact that the books happen in Pittsburgh. They love the writer's obvious love of Pittsburgh. Where I get called out is I get emails from people, and they rarely talk about the plot or the characters. They just say something like, you can't make a left on South Street during traffic. And so I've gotten to the place now. Another example is I think it was in Night Terrors, I have someone at a bar in Wilkinsburg. And then I got like a dozen calls and emails from people going, Wilkinsburg's dry now. There's no bars there, you know. So
keep up, Dennis.
I have to keep, well, now, you know, I'm so gun shy
right,
that I call friends in Pittsburgh and I say, is Heinz Chapel still where I thought it was, you know, because things change so much.
They do. If you don't live there, you know, it's bound to let that sort. But, you know, that's the plus and minus of a real place. If you make up a place, that's world building, and then you can have it the way you want it, but then you still have to keep track of the details. You can't turn left on a street if you set it up in your imaginary world, so I don't know that you can escape.
No, you really can't, and I remember talking to my friend Jim, and I wanted to have someone go by the Penn Hotel, and fairly famous old hotel, and he went, oh, it's earmarked, because he works at the city, because it's earmarked for demolition. I said, oh, I can mention that, you know. Or at least keep it in mind. So I have to find out now, whenever I use place names, you know, in buildings and stuff, I always have to find out if they're still there and what's going on with them, because Pittsburgh constantly changing.
Well, all cities are. But of course, Pittsburgh is a major character in your book.
Yeah.
So, it's Pittsburgh and Daniel, and they're linked
Yeah, they're
inextricably.
very linked.
So,
Well, the thing I like is Daniel has, like I do, a foot in both worlds.
well, he does, but also, he couldn't. He could transfer to some other place, but it would be much more difficult to take an established practice and relocate it, to Boise,
Absolutely.
Idaho or
That's
something.
right.
And so realistically, he's going to stay in
He
Pittsburgh, when
has
he
to stay
also
in
could
Pittsburgh.
probably never consult with another police department.
No.
They wouldn't give him a big recommendation, but credibly speaking, you couldn't really establish him, I think, in that
No.
role in some other place. So there you are, as long as you write about Daniel in Pittsburgh. Speaking of which, just to catch us up here before we come to a halt, what are you working on?
Right now, I'm thinking about the next book, and there are two areas that I'm thinking about. One is clinical conferences. Every therapist goes to clinical conferences, and they are a hotbed of ego, injured feelings, intellectual battles, pride, a lot of affairs. I
I was
mean, they're
just going
really
to say,
terrible.
surely sex.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think there's some great stories, which I can't, we don't have time to talk about, of people presenting and then having an affair with someone who's presented from a different panel, and it just got really ugly. But I thought I might have a murder there because I've never been to a clinic. I've been to dozens of clinical conferences, and I've never been to one where half the attendees didn't want to kill the other half of attendees. So
So
I
it's a
thought
natural.
it's a natural. It just feels like a natural. But the other thing is a hospital. My parents have been going through a lot of medical issues, so I've been flying back to Pittsburgh and spending a lot of time in hospitals. And because of my patients, sometimes I have to, if somebody's on suicide watch or whatever, so I go to UCLA Medical or whatever. And there's something about a hospital that's kind of haunting.
Not only haunting, but a hospital almost acts like an Agatha Christie country house, because it's its own world. I mean, a
Yeah.
hospital truly is its own world when you go into it as a patient or even as a professional. It's quite closed, and there's a whole lot of dynamic and so forth that's there.
Well, one of my dad's doctors is a, when I was there a couple years ago dealing with an issue of his, and she was talking to me just conversationally, and she said, it's like Peyton Place around here. Everybody knows everybody's secrets. Everybody knows which doctors are stealing from the medicine
Okay.
room and stuff. And I thought maybe something where you feel closed in, like a hospital,
Very claustrophobic.
very claustrophobic. That would not involve anyone Daniel knew personally, but he would end up in this little village.
Sure.
So it's either that or the conference. I'm not sure which one.
But you could develop a book out of either. I mean, a hospital is interesting in the sense that death sort of stalks the corridor. Well, death does stalk the
Yeah,
corridors.
that's right.
Not necessarily true at a conference, but I'm sure it will come to you. But they're both good ideas
Yeah,
that
I
you
think they're
can
both good
develop, so
areas for,
it's not like you have to choose.
I don't have to choose. I'll do one and then I'll do the other, but I like it in the sense that, as we said earlier, Daniel can't have a case that's as personally involving his head wounds again.
No, plus he
And
actually got to the truth of
yeah, he
the
got to the
central
groove. Yeah.
mystery of his life, which
Yeah.
is what happened to his wife and why revisit
Yeah.
it.
And so now what I have is the opportunity to try to understand this sort of love triangle he's going to be in with the FBI woman that he was involved in, and the female detective that he was involved in, who has taken a leave of absence. And I'm there, well, his options now are wide open. He has a wide open horizon.
He does. And having settled the matter of his wife's death, his relationship should be more functional.
That's what
That's
I was thinking.
always held him back before.
Yes, it
And
did.
not surprisingly. Well, Dennis, I certainly congratulate you on the fabulous reviews and success you've had for this book. I
Well,
hope it's
thank you.
energized you,
Yes,
vaulting you into
yes.
writing a new one,
Oh,
right?
yes, I'm very energized.
I'm delighted. Well, thank you for talking with
Well,
me.
thank you for having me, Barbara.